Opinion Vertical Line. Conservative thinkers didn't create Trumpism. The New York Times, November 10, 2023, 4:21 p.m. Get credit. Elaine Pylon shared full article by Ross Douthert, opinion columnist. Window.unload equals function. There is a story that professional idea mores like to tell about political history that gives pride of place to their own work. It's a story that usually begins with some small tribe of writers or intellectuals who come up with a set of theories that describe the world in a new way. Marginal at first, their arguments eventually break out into the wider sphere of campaigns and candidates, capturing one or the other major political coalition and finally emerging as the consensus of an age. If you don't sweat the details too much, this story fits the rise of both American progressivism and American conservatism. In the New Deal and the Reagan eras, you could identify an intellectual class that had passed from prophecy to a certain degree of power. And you could arguably see the same pattern in more recent periods of political change. Bill Clinton's style of moderation was anticipated in the small magazine Intellectual Culture of the Washington Monthly and the New Republic. George W. Bush's vision of compassionate conservatism in the writings of Myron Magnin and Martin Olasky. Barack Obama's 2008 campaign by the scribblers of the Netroots and the liberal blogosphere. This fall, I've been co-teaching the course at Yale University, The Crisis of Liberalism, which looks for the roots of today's disturbances in long-running debates about the liberal order. In the past week, we've worked our way up to the 2010s and the rise of both wokeness and right-wing populism, which means I've been thinking more than usual about how ideas work in both of those movements. And one of my thoughts is that both of them break, in different ways, with the familiar narrative about intellectuals and democracy I've just sketched. With wokeness, you have a movement in which the intelligentsia really matters but democratic politics much less so. The ideas that we associate with contemporary social justice progressivism followed the initial part of the script and origination in the 1960s and 1970s, a long period of incubation and development within the American Academy and an emergence into mass consciousness somewhere in the late Obama years. But that emergence worked primarily from the top down. Progressive belief isn't purely an elite phenomenon, but the Great Awakening has largely wielded influence through what Nate Silver calls the Indigo Blob, a center-left network of schools and foundations and media enterprises and human resources departments. It has not really sought power through elections in part, I would argue, because its project is fundamentally therapeutic and educational, placing soulcraft before statecraft. But also because when it's been tested at the ballot box, it's been a loser. That's why President Biden, not Elizabeth Warren, is the leader of the Democratic Party right now, even if some of Warren's ideas have prevailed behind the scenes, through the staffing of the White House. On the right-wing populist side, you have a rather different phenomenon, a political revolution, the earthquake of Trumpism. The similar shocks in Europe that far outruns any theory of what it's about or what it's doing and leaves the intelligentsia rushing to catch up. Yes, of course you can find writers who anticipated right-wing populism to some degree, figures as diverse as Sam Francis and Michael Lind, Pat Buchanan and Christopher Lash. To some extent, I was one of them, co-writing the proto-populist book on how Republicans could win the working class back into 2008 and associating with so-called reform conservatism in the Obama era. But the Paleo-Buchananite school of conservatism wasn't at all ascendant in the Republican Party of the early 2010s, and there was no obvious connection between Donald Trump and any version of the reform conservative movement. We saw the opening he filled, but he didn't need to listen to us in order to fill it. Instead, what you had was a celebrity figure with his own set of ideas, forged in the 1980s and barely altered since, who managed a successful mind meld with a swath of beleaguered voters from both parties. Trumpism certainly has aspects of a cult of personality, but the cult has plenty of doctrines: protectionism, immigration restriction, industrial policy, even if the great leader is flexible about their application. And rather than embrace or vindicate any existing ideological or intellectual movement, Trump often appeared to bypass the idea factories entirely. In a way, these inverse patterns are what you'd expect from the ongoing educational polarization created under current meritocratic conditions, in which one coalition is increasingly the party of the intelligentsia and the other is organized around populist resistance to meritocratic rule. It makes sense that the first coalition would be more idea-driven but more likely to be stampeded into new ideologies through internal pressure. Once a consensus is reached within its ranks, all the smart people and serious institutions agree there's a natural assumption that this can't substitute for democratic persuasion. And it makes sense that the second coalition would be more hostile to any kind of top-down intellectual project, more comfortable with inconsistency and incoherence, and that it would often come to its agenda not through white papers and think tank arguments but through a populist alchemy of the sort that Trump performed. That's not to say that the second kind of process necessarily renders intellectuals irrelevant. Someone is still needed to actually run any political order that the alchemy creates, to fill in all the details of the great man's sketch, to make the inchoate somehow cohere. This can be a thankless and hopeless job, just as some of Trump's functionaries, but it can also be an exciting one, with more space given to the individual thinker than in the somewhat more herd-like atmosphere of the liberal intelligentsia. In confounding the assumptions of the wise, the populist phenomenon also creates a wider sense of political possibility in general. It encourages right-wing intellectuals not just to fill in the blanks of Trumpism but also to imagine further revolutions. If Donald Trump can seemingly impose his worldview on a major political party, what other worldviews might be more viable than we think? You can sense this widening ambition in the conservative writers who first made the leap to Trumpism a feeling of opportunity, not just followership. If only you can catch up to the man on horseback and swing yourself into a saddle, too. And this is part of why right-wing intellectual life became, in my experience, much more interesting and experimental during the wild for years of Trump's presidency, even if the right's intelligentsia didn't actually exert all that much influence over his chaotic administration. There was energy in the effort to make something out of Trumpism, through populist economics and realist or isolationist foreign policy, and new energy in the resistance to that effort among those conservatives who refused the Trumpian revelation. There was also energy in the general widening of debate, the willingness to consider political alternatives that weren't really part of the Trumpian synthesis. Surely no one would confuse Trump with a Catholic integralist or a Christian nationalist, a Marxist Catholic fusionist or a restorer of founding a republican virtue, but that were offered in the spirit of radical or reactionary possibility that his unexpected triumph opened up. But this sense of excitement and energy also yields the great temptation for conservative intellectuals and ideologists, which was embodied most fully by a figure like John Eastman in the days around January 6, the temptation to see in Trumpian chaos a ladder for your own vision of a renewed America and to deliberately exacerbate that chaos for purposes that don't really command any substantial democratic support. Kamen Linker, in an essay on right-wing intellectuals last week, analyzed this temptation in terms of its apocalypticism, a belief that things in America or the West are so bad, so far gone, that the most procedurally radical moves are justifiable and necessary, even under constitutional crisis. I have a number of disagreements with Linker, both about the substantive ideas of some of the intellectuals he folds into his analysis and about the near-term political influence of certain far-right vitalists and technomonarchists, as notable as their ideas may be. But clearly the impulse he describes exists, and it's played a part in encouraging some conservatives to embrace the power trips of an unstable demagogue. I'm less sure, though, about whether emphasizing the sense of doom fully captures this mentality's appeal. It's just as much, if not more, about possibility, the excitement of living through a revolution and playing a dramatic part. Thus the seeming paradox of right-wing intellectualism in the age of populism. In one sense, the lesson of Trump's ascent for conservative intellectuals should have been a humbling one, the harsh message of you are not in control. But that loss of certainty was also felt as emancipation, proof that the goddess fortuna can still overrule the sophists and calculators, and there need actually be fewer limits on the intellectual's political ambitions because the goddess, as we know, shows special favoritism to the bold. Breviary Tom Binney on the New Agnosticism, Rod Dreher and Diana Walsh Pajolka on U.F.O.S and the Supernatural Lex Pryor on the Holy City of Halloween, Philip Goff on the Trouble with the Multiverse, the Mysterious Mathematical Beauty of Gothic Architecture, New Survey Data on Gen Z's Polarization of the Sexes, Are We Sure Inequality Has Risen? This week in Decadence, America will enter the 22nd century with a shrinking population unless immigration increases, according to new U.S. Census Bureau projections released Thursday. The U.S. population will begin declining after reaching a peak of nearly 370 million people in 2080, per the Census Bureau's most likely scenario. In almost all scenarios, Immigration was projected to be the largest contributor to population growth, as it has been for decades. When the Bureau considered the zero immigration scenario, the country's population began declining almost immediately and would drop to 226 million by 2100. The Bureau believes 29.1% of the population will most likely be older than 65 and 16.4% will be children by 2100. Around 2038, the country will likely begin experiencing more deaths than births annually. Jacob Knutson, Census Projects U.S. Population Bust by 2080, Axios November 9. Ross Douthat has been an opinion columnist for The Times since 2009. He is the author, most recently, of End Number 8220, The Deep Places, A Memoir of Illness and Discovery. End Number 8221, at Douthat NYD Facebook Share Full Article.